Hello, and welcome to The Learning College. I'm your happy host, Alex P. Linder. Today we're going to do Chapter 11 of George Lincoln Rockwell's later 1960s book, White Power. I believe it might have been the last before he was very unfortunately assassinated. Certainly one of the great white men of the post-World War Jew, period. Now, this is fairly long, and my time is limited to 2 hours. I don't know if we'll take it up, but maybe not too far from it. Let's get right to it. As always, you can find everything permanently archived at vnnforum.com. And when it's up and functioning correctly, pieville.net. Again, George Lincoln Rockwell, White Power, Chapter 11. It's called Nightmare. I remember he's used a metaphor of Captain at Sea and other, but I think he's going to tell a little bit of a story here. White Power, Chapter 11, Nightmare. It's hot. The night atmosphere is heavy and oppressive. All the windows are open. You can hear a siren a few blocks away, the kids screaming in the street, and even the drunken voices of the O'Malleys and their usual argument. Painting you a picture of like tenement-style New York with immigrants. I mean, 1960 is almost closer to 2010 than when I'm recording this in middle of winter 2024. I'm just making a point. Again, what I do is audio, not audio books. So there is commentary. So he's painting a city sort of scene. But no breath of air comes through the windows. You lean back in your squeaky wicker chair, t-shirt wet with perspiration. Even the little fan oscillating back and forth just emphasizes the brutal heat and sweatiness of the air when a fan momentarily brushes you. You'll remember that air conditioning was not even a thing until the 20th century, and even then it took a while to spread, invented by Willis Carrier. Others are claimed, but Willis Carrier out of New York thought about it when he was on a train platform and conceived the right way to do it. A white genius, underappreciated, but not by me, and hopefully not by you. Learning to appreciate things is part of what a learning college is all about. If you don't start with gratitude is tied to understanding. Ingratitude is tied to incomprehension, confusion, belief, even to paranoia, belief that others are oppressing you who are actually elevating you. To approach things with open eyes, you may have preconceived ideas or not, it doesn't matter, but look at them and try to see them for what they are. Don't judge them until you have enough to judge them. So he's painting someone sweating and sitting in a wicker chair. You turn on the TV and take a gulp of beer out of the cold can. It seems like only another hot August night. Only somehow this one's different. You can feel it. There's an air of tension, expectancy, foreboding. The news has been bad. But then it's been bad ever since the riots began way back in June. Are you getting a little proto-Pierce vibe? Remember, Pierce worked for him. When he would go on to write Turner Diaries, you can pick up a little of that. Maybe reading some of this from Rockwell would have given him ideas for his own novel. You've gotten used to the riots every summer since 1963. Now, in 1971, see, he's projecting a little of the future. He didn't know he would be dead by, I think, 68. And he's writing this in like 67, 68, I'm not sure which. The summers are expected to be periods of almost open warfare between blacks and whites. So he's projecting forward, as Pierce was wont to do, from the trend lines of the so-called, and it's a Jew propaganda term, civil rights, which is really an anti-white, anti-free association, hence anti-constitutional movement. He's projecting forward the trends that are already easy to observe in the summer of love period. Even the winters aren't real truces anymore as they used to be in the 60s. There are outbreaks of the Black and White War, even in the coldest winter months. But always the harried authorities have managed somehow to restore some kind of order. By whites staying out of black areas, they have managed to keep working and keep up some pretense of civilized life. I just imagine what you'd think of today. But this year, the riots have been almost constant. The TV in front of you has just shown dramatic pictures of what's going on in other cities. The searchlights stabbing into the city night, highlighting black faces distorted with hate, fighting the police and National Guard troops, the gunfire and the blazing buildings where Molotov cocktails have sent up whole blocks in flames. However, it's been quiet in your city now almost for 2 weeks. The cops and the soldiers beat down the last uprising by the blacks before it got out of the Negro area only a few blocks. The TV newscaster is telling how another boatload of black saboteurs, fresh from guerrilla training in Cuba, has been intercepted after a running gun battle in the Caribbean and has been prevented from landing in Florida. Just imagine what you think today. You are sick of it. Sick to death of this eternal trouble, these black mobs and communist agitators, raising hell, raping, killing, rising up and burning, looting, and threatening whole cities. You turn off the TV, and this guy writing in the late 60s. Back then, it's much more black and white, because the Immigration Act of 65 had just been passed and were yet filled with mestizos and brown skins. So it's 90% white and 10% descendants of slaves, is how it was. But then by 1975, you'd already have Campus Saints, which we recorded the audio of, talking about just boats just showing up and swamping Europe, as is going on as I speak in 2024. Eternal, the evergreen truth is what we're after here, taking the ephemera of news pegs, pegging them to the eternal truth of agendas. Anti-white agendas coming from the Jew have been there from time immemorial. As long as the Jews have existed, they've been hostile to all other groups of people, and whites particularly, because whites were the big dogs, the most dangerous foe, and they created Christianity, they created conservatism, these other isms, and communism in order to racially destroy whites. That's your takeaway. And the other people are just pawns to be used by Jews as they see fit, best fit, to pull off their tricks, their overthrows, their subversions. You turn off the TV. It's always a good idea. You gaze up at the ceiling in the growing darkness, wondering where in hell it will end, how it will end. The heavy, hot air of August is laden with sounds of automobile horns, kids shouting, neighbors hollering, and somebody practicing the piano nearby. Mid-century modern nostalgia, huh? More sips of beer, getting warm as you reach the bottom of the can. You want to get your mind off the damn niggers for a change. You turn on the light to read the Western paperback you bought on the way home. Then you hear it. First you think it's some kind of crowd cheering at a ball game. There's the sound of a tremendous number of people shouting a long, long way off. But somehow it's different from any sports crowd. There's a vicious, deadly sound to this roaring mob. You get up from the wicker chair and go to the window. Over the black silhouette of the brick apartments to the east, you see the familiar glow. Fires. So it started again. Why can't they kill all those black bastards once and for all and put an end to this crazy business? To hell with it. You won't watch this time. You close the window, go back and turn the TV back on. Maybe you can get your mind off the everlasting nigger trouble by watching some movie or comedy show. With the window shut, it seems for a moment you've gotten away from the damnable nigger hell. Maybe he's watching Gunsmoke. With the TV on, you can't hear the mob or the occasional gunfire. You get another cold beer and try to relax in the glow of the TV too. Just as you get interested in a Western, the damn thing goes dead on you. You get up to wiggle the plug. Sometimes you can fix it that way. Yeah, back in the 70s, if you're young, you used to be able to slap TVs around like a bad wife and get them to act right. True story, bro. Then you notice that the fan is off too. Must be a fuse. So you go into the kitchen and look into the fuse box with the flashlight. No fuses are blown. but by then you're already beginning to notice all the lights are off, even the street light, which usually shines into the kitchen window. It's really black. You're not used to such total darkness, such absence of any glow or reflected light at all. It gives you an eerie feeling. You stick your head out the kitchen window. Outside, there is something new, something evil. You don't know what it is, but it grips your heart with fingers of ice. It's silent in your neighborhood. No more kids shouting. No more piano practicing. No more quarreling at the O'Malley's. Nothing. Just silence. Dead, empty, heavy silence. The quiet lends impact to the distant sounds of the mob down in the central part of the city. In the silent dark, in which you can see nothing, the sounds of the black mob down there are amplified and emphasized until they seem to be coming at you. In the darkness outside your window, you hear Jack Morgan, who's been drinking beer in his front steps, hollering to his wife upstairs, "Don't worry, honey, it's just a power failure. They'll have it on in a little while. Keep your shirt on." A kid begins to cry, then another. There is an excited but hushed buzz outside as the neighborhood tries to adjust to the total darkness. Everybody is listening to the sound of that black mob in town, but reassuring each other that the authorities will soon put down the rebellion, as they always have. Then you hear Mrs. Johnson calling to a neighbor for some water. "Something's wrong with mine," Mrs. Johnson hollers. "I can't get any water to fix the baby's bottles." Then, from most of the neighbors all at once, you hear that everybody's water is off. You realize that something must be seriously wrong and pick up the phone to call the cops. At least you can report that the water is off in your neighborhood. The phone's dead. Remembering your transistor radio, you turn it on. Little handheld radios or desktop consoles people used to listen to back then, even into my early years in the early 70s. "The public is asked to remain calm until the National Guard can restore order. Stay in your homes and do not panic. There is nothing about the present emergency any different." Oh my God! Ah! Reminds you of that horror movie, doesn't it? The black and white one. What? One of the best horror movies ever made in the 60s, Night of the Living Dead. Over the tiny speaker in the radio comes the unmistakable gurgling sound of a man gasping his last breath. Just before the station goes off the air, you hear, "How you like that, you white motherfucker?" You lean out the window. "Did you hear that?" You holler to the neighborhood in general. "Hear what?" comes from a dozen throats. So clearly an urban environment where the people are packed in. "I just turned on my pocket radio and heard what sounded like an announcer getting killed right on the air. Then they went off." "Try another station." "I already have," comes from somebody else. "They're all off." "I'm getting my guns," you holler. "Better be careful," shouts a neighbor. "You know the new laws on guns." Again, you'll see the very strong similarity to Turner Diaries, although this is written before. And again, Pierce was his associate. "To hell with the new laws," you roar. "If those black bastards come messing around here, they're going to get shot. I don't care if they throw me in jail for it. I'm not going to let those filthy niggers shoot up and burn this place and hurt our women." But before you can grab your hidden guns and get out front, they are here. A car comes screeching around the block, tossing Molotov cocktails and firing automatic weapons. In the glare of the flaming gasoline bombs, you see the white eyes and the black faces. But even if you couldn't see them, you know what they are by their filthy language. As usual, they are drunk and roaring typical black curses on all white people, liberal, rich, poor, right-wing, Klan, any white man. As the carload of black terrorists disappears, still firing, you can hear the screams of the dying and the expressions of horror from people whose loved ones have been shot to death. You grab your old Marine Corps M1 and the 38 and take the steps, even in the dark, 3 and 4 at a time. Outside, in the flickering light of the fires, surrounded by moans and prayers of your neighbors, you find a little group of men who have had enough service experience not to panic. A Korean War, World War II. They have their guns ready and are trying to decide what to do. You suggest that somebody be sent over to the police station over on Grand. They all agree. A kid with two pistols volunteers. He disappears into the dark. You don't know the cops are all dead. Just as you are discussing where each guy will be posted, another carload of the bastards comes roaring back toward town from the suburbs, blasting away. You hit the deck, slam home the bolt of the old M1, and feel a surge of satisfaction when the old rifle rattles off each round at the black terrorist. You can hear one of the sons of bitches scream as he's hit. Reminds you of the war. But then you remember, this is home. This is where your wife and kids live. And that brings a new and horrible thought. The wife and kids are visiting across town. What's happening there? Your heart stops for a moment, but then fury surges up within you. If they've touched Janie and those little kids, you begin to consider your position. No lights, no water, no phone, no radio, few guns, fewer still who know how to use them and have the guts to use them, and no organization, and very little ammo. While you're thinking about all this, a matter of only minutes since the first attack, here come three more cars. You blast away with the M1, you hit another one, but the rest of the guys are firing away at nothing, wasting the few rounds of ammo you've got. You yell at them to cease fire. It's too late. They're all out of ammo. The groans and crying and prayers of the people who have been hit have demoralized most of the rest of the people. Surprisingly, a lot of the women seem tougher than the men and are doing their best with torn skirts and shirts for bandages and what comfort they can provide with words. Many of the men, especially the younger jive generation, that would be a step on the degradation from, say, classical music through jazz to rap. The younger men of the jive generation with the long hair and the stoop shoulders, as opposed to square shoulders, are acting like a bunch of teenage girls, screaming and screeching, begging somebody to help them. Help them. You'd like to help them with a good kick in the ass. Now it's no longer dark. The whole neighborhood is blazing. The fires set by the flaming gasoline are burning viciously. There's nothing to stop them. No fire department, not even any water. The night was already oppressively hot. Now, with many houses roaring infernos of flame, the heat makes your skin shrivel. Already, many others are moving onto a vacant lot, trying to get away from the searing flames. You hear a man and his young wife screaming at each other a few houses away. She is trying to run back into their house to get something before it burns up. He is holding her while she struggles and screams. Their kids huddle around her, crying. She never gets to go into the house. A carload of blacks see her in her nightgown as they go by. They shoot her husband and her kids. They grab her and drag her screaming into the car, laughing insanely and boasting to each other what they are going to do. And you can't do a damn thing with empty guns. Within minutes, two more carloads of the black devils roar into the neighborhood. But these don't keep going, shooting like the others. They get out to loot and rape. Most of the men around you have long since scrambled off to hide in terror. You can do little else yourself. From under a bush on somebody's lawn, shaded from the worst of the blazing heat and light, you watch the black savages grabbing everything they want. Radios, TVs, and women. God, you never thought you'd see a sight like this. You'd read about it happening far away in the Congo and other places, but always thought it was something you'd never see here. Move on to page 188 of 272 on the PDF. Now you are forced to watch, helplessly, while six of the black animals rip the clothes off the little teenage O'Malley girl and rape her, one after the other, after murdering her mother, father, and brothers. At first she screams and struggles desperately, but after two or three of the lustful black beasts have beaten her and had their way, she lies whimpering. Then there's no more whimpering. All night the horror continues. The houses burn to black ruins, and still they burn. The carloads of Negroes roam at will through the neighborhood, looting, murdering the wounded just for pleasure and raping. You are helpless, beaten. Finally, about 3 a.m., things slow down a bit. You crawl out and call to some others still alive. Where the hell is the National Guard? You keep repeating to each other dazedly, stupidly, where in the hell is the goddamn guard? You are the only one with enough experience and leadership to try to do anything at all. You suggest gathering the wounded and helpless and trying to get them all together behind a pile of old bricks and stone in the vacant lot. The wounded are crying, really crying for water, but there is no water. Nobody thinks of food yet. That will come later. But for now, everybody is just trying to survive. And every minute, you can hear the roar of the huge mob in the central city moving out, getting nearer. The others agree to try to get the wounded down behind the brick pile. But before you can finish the job, you hear a new noise. The clanking motor noises you remember from the war. Tanks. The guard, at last. It's the National Guard, you shout to others. I can hear the tanks. They all listen. A feeble cheer goes up as they all hear the tanks. Just in time, too, because now the black mob is within blocks. You can imagine just what it would be like if that black swarm of bloodthirsty Africans gets here to finish off the remaining survivors. Now the tanks are moving in to restore order at last. You feel for the first time that you will survive, and you resolve never to be caught like this again, never to be disorganized and so poorly armed, if the bastards ever try to do it again. Gun laws or no gun laws, you resolve to be ready. The noise of the tanks gets closer, closer. Now you can see them. Thank God. The iron monsters are clanging along the streets, clearing them with infantry troops moving in behind them in full battle gear. My God, what a beautiful, delicious, gorgeous sight. Nothing ever looks so beautiful. Slowly, in a daze, those able to walk begin to move out from behind a brick pile. The tanks and troops uncover a swarm of blacks hiding in a construction project. The infantry troops move in to round them up. The tanks stop. But what's this? What the hell? What are the tanks doing now? They're turning. They're not waiting for the infantry to finish off the black terrorists to the construction project. They're turning back. My God, don't they know there are hundreds of white people out there helpless? But they're not just turning back. The tanks have swiveled around their guns and are going at their own infantry troops. What the hell? And while you're still stunned, the tanks open up with machine guns and their own infantry and mow them down, hundreds of them. Then the top of the lead tank pops open, and you know why. A big black head comes out, grinning. Now there is silence among the little band of men, women, and children behind the bricks. They are too stunned even to curse. Nobody needs to explain. They realize now what has happened. The great majority of the blacks in the armed forces and the National Guard have joined the black rebellion. Now the mighty technical weapons of the United States are in the hands of black savages, only a few generations removed from animal life in the jungle. Rockets, tanks, nuclear bombs, all that white genius created to protect itself, stupidly and treasonably turned over to the enemy himself in the name of brotherhood and equality. You use the last reserves of your will and energy to herd the tiny band of your surviving neighbors down into an abandoned cellar under the bricks and wreckage. Now you alone, you are alone against a world gone mad. No water, no food, no ammunition, no communication, no medicine, no nothing. But you aren't going to give up yet. Maybe it's only local. Maybe the Army or the Marine Corps, somebody will be able to get control of this revolt of the jungle. If only you can hold out, maybe help will come. But their tanks are followed now by swarms of blacks streaming out of the city, drunk with whiskey and blood, acting precisely as their kind of people have acted from time immemorial in the African jungles, with animal ferocity and bloodthirstiness. Every white soldier and National Guardsman in the area is dead, many mutilated, taken by complete surprise by their own black, quote, comrades. Day dawns, hot, more horrible than the night, filled with smoke and flames. Dozens of moaning wounded lie all around you, crowded down in there under the rocks and bricks. The cries for water, particularly from the kids, are endless and heartbreaking. But there is no water. You can do nothing. About 8 o'clock, things have become fairly quiet in your neighborhood. Only the crackling, arid stepping of the fires all around can be heard. Then you hear a wail from the street. You peek out and see one of the Negroes you shot last night crawling, moaning, and crying for help. You dare not move. But suddenly one of the bravest of the women folk, a woman who has been comforting and bandaging and helping the wounded and dying all night long, dashes out from under the shelter. She runs toward the black man in the street. You watch with horror while she plunges a big kitchen knife again and again and again into the quivering black body. You recognize her. It's Mrs. Moody, the liberal. She's contributed hundreds of dollars to the blacks, helped them endlessly, marched in their picket lines, sat in with them, even gone to Mississippi to register with them as voters. Register them as voters. Now you watch her out there, finally asserting the animal wisdom God gave her. That might be a good phrase for you to remember and use. If you get in arguments, you're just thinking the animal wisdom God gave her. You can't drive biology and self-preservation away with morality, and if you try to, that's sickness. It's a sick ism foisted on you by Jews who foist bad ideas or the niggers of your mind and the mental intellectual counterpart or anti-intellectual counterpart to the actual niggers on the street he's describing. This former liberal woman is using the, quote, animal wisdom God gave her to protect her own. Last night, her husband and kids were murdered. Mrs. Moody is no more liberal. Now she's a member of the great white race, a fighter. But it's too late. At 10 o'clock, you see more blacks roaming around the neighborhood, picking over the ruins, kicking the dead, ripping the clothes off females, and laughing insanely at their unspeakable atrocities, just like the Mau Mau brothers in Africa, thing in Kenya back in the day. For the whole day, you manage, remember, the area of decolonizing or colonialism coming to an end, the British and French retreating from Africa. See Africa Audio, the movie. Look it up. It's made by a couple Italian leftists showing the reality of Africa, newly liberated from human rule, left to its own jungle devices. Africa Audio, like ADDIO, made by Italian leftists in the 60s. For the whole day, you manage to survive and keep the little group together, but several die and the thirst becomes unbearable for all of you. About 7 o'clock, when the summer night is still hot with sunshine, you have to watch a little girl die in her mother's arms. She keeps crying for her mommy, and her mother keeps crooning, "Mommy's right here, darling, right here, I'm right here," and sobbing softly, rocking the little curly-headed kid back and forth, until the little head falls sideways. Your eyes fill with tears and your heart with rage at the idiots and political rats that brought the greatest nation on earth to this, and all in the name of brotherhood and progress. Progress. In about 8, you can hear a sound truck in the distance. For a long time, it cruises around and you can't figure out what it is saying. Maybe not a megaphone or something like that. Then it begins to move into your neighborhood, and you can hear the message rasping from the loudspeakers. "This is the new socialist democratic people's government of the United States. We have overthrown the racist hate government of the United States. United Nations Ambassador Alfred Goldberg has already recognized the new people's democracy. The armed forces of the National Guard are in our hands. United Nations Chinese troops are now landing at all airports to assist the freedom-loving People's Liberation Army in restoring order. Resistance is useless. Nothing can move without our permission and the entire nation. You are ordered to come out of hiding and report to the nearest registration point for movement to a prepared refugee area where you will be fed and then put to work.
after 9 p.m. tonight, all those who have not checked into registration centers will be shot. This is the new Socialist Democratic People's Government of the United States. The Armed Forces and the National Guard of the United...
A repetition of the message, recorded message.
And the truck went out in the neighborhood playing its message of doom for our nation over and over. So it's your classic take of reports of the high school football field and then by nine or be shot. And then you get there and you get shot anyway. Your eyes blurred with tears, you watch most of the people stumble up and out of the hiding place and begin to wander around looking for the registration points. You have found one round to put in your 38. You point it at your head. Then you notice a pretty young girl looking up at you. A silent prayer in her eyes. You hand her the pistol and stumble out of the hole before you hear the explosion. George Lincoln Rockwell says, "What I have written is no hysterical pipe dream of an alarmist. Precisely this sort of thing is planned, in detail, by the enemy, and has already been put into bloody action wherever the blacks have risen up in places like Portuguese Angola." See what Jan has said about that, historyreviewed.com. "The Congo, Kenya, etc., against the whites who built those countries. Here in America, it has already started. The way a deadly disease starts with first a small pimple, then a sore, then more and more, until finally it breaks out with a raging fever and lays the victim low. The liars and chart forgers," again, his initial figure of Jews giving us bad navigation charts, sea figure, sea metaphor, analogy, "have done everything possible," the chart forgers, "to camouflage the real nature of the riots spreading all over America and to pretend that they are the result of frustration and can be cured by making things better for the Negro." Jews always justify black violence against whites. They encourage it, they promote it, they solicit it, they intend it, and they benefit from it. Anyone that means that ill toward you and your race has to be exterminated. Let me first point out that the number and viciousness of these riots is directly proportional to the degree of welfare and freedom, quote-unquote, lavished on the Negroes. There have been no Watts-style riots in Mississippi, i.e. the poorest of the poor, where there is a more realistic attitude toward the blacks, and therefore more control. It is in the big cities of the North and the West that they have had the most fearful riots, although the Northern politicians are on their knees kissing the toes of the arrogant blacks. So, you know, 50, 60 years before, he's describing what goes on in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and the BLM garbage. Around "I Can't Breathe," George Floyd. So the pattern holds even long after his death. But the blacks demand more and ever more and will never be satisfied, short of sacking the city and massacring whites as their African brothers have already done in Kenya and the Congo. The liars and chart forgers never tell the American people what is behind all this rioting, continually repeating that it is spontaneous and the result of hundreds of years of oppression. These lies have succeeded well enough so that most Americans really believe that the riots simply erupt on hot summer nights because the poor oppressed Negroes can't stand the frustration, quote-unquote, anymore. First, of course, there is the point that it is just as hot and frustrating for millions of poor white people, but they don't rush out with bombs and guns to riot and loot. To judge just how wickedly false and dangerous is this, quote, spontaneous riot bit, you must know the background, the decades of patient communist planning and organization which has gone into producing them. We have already presented the statements of Israel Cohen from 1912, reprinted in the Congressional Record, that the chief weapon of the communist in overthrowing the USA would be the Negroes. Chapter 9. Before World War II, Eugene Dennis, National Secretary of the Communist Party of the United States, laid out the plan in more detail. Here is an actual quote from Dennis's book, A Soviet America. A Soviet means council. run by like councils of so-called workers who are actually rotten Jews. As quoted by Kenneth Goff, ex-communist associate of Dennis, in his book, Confessions of Stalin's Agent, Eugene Dennis, Confessions of Stalin's Agent, book I have not seen or read. Quote, at that hour, large race riots are supposed to take place every city of any size. Leaders of these mobs are to be carefully chosen and trained in advance. The disturbances are to be of some extent as to require sending large forces of police to those areas. While the authorities are trying to quell these riots, picked bands of communists are to seize their radio and TV stations and telephone exchanges. Flying squads of communists are to seize control of the water supply and shut it off. Also electrical power and gas. Homes will be without water and fuel, light and telephone. It will be impossible for the people to communicate with friends and relatives. Professional murderers will round up the people in the business districts in some of the large buildings and hold the men as hostages, while their women are to be turned over to sex-crazed mobs unless the men surrender. Notice the call, says Rockwell, for the shutting off of electricity, gas, etc., as he depicted in his scene. This has been the standard plan of Mau Mau attack on urban cities of the white man all over Africa. First, they smash the power station and the telephone, etc. Then, in the blackness and confusion, they strike with their bloody African terror. I have already shown in Chapter 4 how William Wyland, W.E.I., and our own State Department conspired with incredible arrogance to oust pro-American Batista, Cuba, who had severed relations with the communist nations, and install the rabid communist Fidel Castro. This was for a purpose, but not the simple purpose of helping communism in general. The conspirators needed a base in the New World for the launching of their Black Terror campaign, masquerading as a civil rights movement. Civil rights as a propaganda cover term for Black Terror campaign. Among other things, they wanted a radio station able to flood the minds of millions of American Negroes with their agitational propaganda and a safe refuge for terrorists as Laos and Vietnam, as the communists fighting the Americans could run into Laos where we weren't allowed to fight, technically at least. If you go out and do your hit-and-run attacks and then flee into the safety of Laos, they could do that with Cuba, he's saying. With the capture of Cuba by Castro, arranged by traitors in our own government and press, communist training camps were organized where communist black terrorists can learn all the techniques to implement the usual terrorist, quote, war of liberation, and where equipment for sabotage, poisoning of reserves and food supplies can be smuggled into the United States. Remember how Castro lived in the Teresa Hotel in Harlem when he came to the UN? Few people realize that Castro is one quarter Negro and his revolution is as much black as red. The Cuban spearhead of communist black terrorism, only 90 miles from our American coast, has been guaranteed by the USA against any attack by Cuban patriots seeking to free their homeland. Kennedy and Khrushchev put on a big fake drama about missiles and their removal, all of which we successfully predicted in the Rockwell report, knowing exactly what they were up to. Remember, he's a former Navy guy, very high up Navy guy, so he has a good idea about this kind of stuff. As we heard in earlier chapters. The end result of this missile charade, the Cuban Missile Crisis, was that there was never any inspection, but the U.S. Navy was ordered to protect the Cuban coast from any possible landings by Cuban patriots, and this is still going on, with Cuban anti-Castroites being seized on the high seas at gunpoint and delivered to prison in America for attempting to free their own country. Kennedy's lack of air support at the Bay of Pigs caused the failure of the counter-revolution. Not only that, but Eleanor Roosevelt and a gang of similar Reds and Pinkos organized a giant support operation to pay enormous sums of blackmail and supply vast stores of rare equipment to Castro, ostensibly to rescue anti-Castro Cubans, although one U.S. Navy task force could have rescued the refugees and Cuba in one day. As soon as Cuba was a secure and heavily armed camp, aimed like a dagger at the heart of America, the head of the NAACP in Monroe, North Carolina, a big black buck named Robert Williams, launched a tribal armed rebellion and kidnapped a white couple as hostages. When his rebellion was finally beat down, he fled to the prepared refuge in Cuba and organized the radio operation already planned, quote, Radio Free Dixie. On one of these first Cuban broadcasts, Williams gloated, quote, We failed with armed rebellion in Monroe only because it was our first try and we made mistakes. We actually had enough force and arms to reduce the area to ashes and rubble. We did beat the police and emergency forces. What stopped us was the importation of terrorist state troopers from other areas. Had we attacked in these other areas too and tied down these forces, we would have succeeded. What the church forgers and liars have not told Americans is that the entire blueprints for the big city riots are all laid out in Williams' publication, The Crusader, which was first published in Cuba. Here's the cover of the issue which actually predicted the Watts riots, 1965, and laid out the technique, even to the slogan, Let It Burn. And here's more precise plans from The Crusader for exactly how they are doing it, and why they believe they can beat the entire USA, just as set forth in the first part of this chapter. And this is a quote. When massive violence comes, the USA will become a bedlam of confusion and chaos. The factory workers will be afraid to venture out on the street to report to their jobs. The telephone workers and radio workers will be afraid to report. All transportation will ride to a complete standstill. Stores will be destroyed and looted. Property will be damaged, and expensive buildings will be reduced to ashes. Essential pipelines will be severed and blown up, and all manner of sabotage will occur. Violence and terror will spread like a firestorm. A clash will occur inside the armed forces. At U.S. military bases around the world, local revolutionaries will side with the Afro-GIs, because of the vast area covered by the Holocaust, U.S. forces will be spread too thin for effective action. U.S. workers who are caught in their jobs will try to return home to protect their families. Trucks and trains will not move the necessary supplies to the big urban centers. The economy will fall into a state of chaos. This racist imperialist oppressor will not be brought to his knees simply because of the fighting ability and military power of black freedom fighters and their allies inside the U.S., but because of the creation of economic, chaotic conditions, total disorganization, frustration of his essential end, ultra-vital organs of production in adverse conditions created by the worldwide liberation struggle. So just destroy stuff generally is a... creates the conditions for the Black Revolution. And the creating of those conditions is the Black Revolution at the start. Such formidable enemy will fall prey to the new concept of revolution because of this ultra-modern and automated society and the lack of psychological conditioning of its forces. Our people have already been conditioned by almost 400 years of violence, terror, and hunger. They're like, we're game fit. We've been down for years. Down for centuries. Shit, man. The new concept of revolution defies military science and tactics. The new concert lightning campaigns conducted in highly sensitive urban communities, with the paralysis reaching the small communities and spreading to the farm areas. The old method of guerrilla warfare, as carried out in the hills and countryside of Fidel Castro, would be ineffective in a power country like the USA. Any such force would be wiped out in an hour. The new concept is to huddle as close to the enemy as possible so as to neutralize his modern and fierce weapons. The new concept creates conditions that involve the total community, whether they want to be involved or not. It sustains a state of confusion and destruction of property. It dislocates the organs of harmony and order and reduces central power to the level of a helpless, sprawling octopus. Essentially take out their communications and their utilities. Leave them in the dark, blind, and they're limited only to their physical. no extension to the ear and eye through electronic means once the Blex have destroyed the infrastructure en route to taking power. During the hours of day, sporadic rioting takes place and massive sniping. Night brings out all warfare, organized fighting, and unlimited terror against the oppressor and his forces. Such a campaign will bring about an end to oppression and social injustice in the USA in less than 90 days and create the basis for the implementation of the U.S. Constitution with justice and equality for all people. It is no longer a truism that our people cannot win such a struggle. The world has changed, and the favor of the situation has shifted to the side of the Afro-American. Those who cry that we cannot win are either agents of the oppressor, latent masochists, or ignorant of the new facts of life. We do not need paternal white big daddies for our friends now. What we need are some fighting John Browns. He, of course, was the 1800s radical white, not a black. He was a white who murdered people to liberate the blacks, later got killed for it, but he's revered as a hero by the white left, Jews, and even the blacks. Our friends are growing throughout the world, they continue, he continues, while those of our oppressors are diminishing, and the crusader from Cuba. It is important that we immediately create stronger ties with our brothers of Latin America, and again, Asia and Africa, and again, the opening of the borders in 65, right when all this is going on. It is important that our people stop cooperating with our oppressor and exert more effort to expose his beastly ways to the peoples of the world. Yes, we can win because our struggle is just and our friends are many. The handwriting is already on the wall. Victory is now within our reach. Let us prepare to seize it, in all caps with an exclamation point. Now, says Rockwell, read this photostatic reproduction of a broadcast of their Radio Free Dixie to millions of U.S. Negroes, and you will have a better idea of what the riots and F-raising by Negroes means and what's ahead for America if something drastic is not done, and soon. But it would take a lot longer than he thought, because if something's if time's on your side, you can just afford to operate degree by degree by degree. A Radio Free Dixie broadcast. 0 hour approaches. Yeah, this is a black out of Cuban who fomented a failed insurrection in North Carolina, fled Cuba, and is now creating propaganda for War of Dixie liberation for blacks. 0 hour approaches. It's a radio broadcast, a radio free Dixie broadcast. Funny how it's kind of reversed today and it sounds like white language, doesn't it? Zero hour approaches. The winds of turmoil and violence approach the shores of oppression and discontent. The racist forces of tyranny and hate sweeping out of the distance to cast havoc on our dehumanized, so-called violent and helpless people. In this crucial hour of the long and bitter struggle for the survival of our black people in racist America, the philosophy of... there's a misprint of violence is a pathway to suicide and extermination. The racist oppressed people in North America is a savage brute. He is a raging beast devoid of human sensibilities. Those deluded dupes who speak of the power of nonviolence and love in taming the wrath of racist white savages are no more than recklessly leading our brutally oppressed peoples down the violent blood of genocide, violent bloody path of genocide. So, again, you've got MLK preaching love, and the Jews are working both ways. They work the nonviolent and the violent at the same time. They feed and play off each other while appearing to be opposed, like the Republicans and Democrats, the conservatives and the liberals. The racist thug advocates of white supremacy have a mortal fear of self-defense on the part of our long submissive people. This is because the fact that the United States' position in the world is so sensitive, and today, that any long-drawn massive rioting across the nation would sound a death knell for the farce of the so-called democratic way of life. Contrary to what UNC and racist buffoons would have our people believe, it is not the Negro who would be exterminated in such a, I guess that's a United Negro Congress or something, one of the peaceful organizations, or the ones, the path of nonviolence versus violence is the key thing here. He's making fun of the nonviolent way. Contrary to what the UNC and the racist buffoons would have our people believe, it is not the Negro who would be exterminated in such a conflict, but the so-called American way of those racist imperialists who conspire to conquer, dominate, and spread Birmingham-type justice around the world. Remember that endlessly heard of bombing of the Birmingham church. All the civilized peoples of the world are in sympathy with our struggle to civilize the master race savages and their jungle called representative democracy of the Christian USA. Knowing what the communist forces of liberation have done in the Congo, Kenya, Vietnam, and all over the planet in the way of wholesale slaughter and torture, rape and pillage, can you have any doubt left as to what is ahead for America? Does the first part of the chapter still seem improbable? It shouldn't, not to anybody who sees the historical pattern that has been developing, unhindered, for half a century now. The white man once ruled the world with an iron, relatively just and humane hand. There were abuses, but nothing like what happens. This is Rockwell again, obviously. The white man once ruled the world with an iron, relatively just and humane hand. There were abuses, but nothing like what happens when rule is turned over to the so-called colored races. The white man is dominated and civilized. Now that the white man has become, quote, too liberal to fight, as Khrushchev boasted, and will no longer enforce civilized conduct in the backward colored races, they are rising up like unleashed jungle animals all over the earth and sinking their fangs into the jugular veins of their one-time masters. It has already happened to the people of Kenya. Whites scoffed at the idea that the Mau Mau could ever win by their primitive and bloody voodoo and terrorism, but the Mau Mau did win. The Mau Mau devil, Kenyatta, now rules Kenya, including the whites who waited too long to leave. The whites of the Congo and a dozen other places waited too long before realizing what was up, and they are now dead, raped, or gone. In Rhodesia, the whites finally realized what was ahead and have made a brave stand to protect themselves and civilization, but they would lose too, as we know. Of course, they were being attacked in the media and trying to defend themselves, going for independence and Britain not backing them as an early part of the EU. Anti-white ideology, but he was dead before that all played out, but he could see the pattern. Just like Pierce, he could see the pattern. If you know the trends and you know what's causing the trends and nothing is countering the trends, let alone stopping the trends will continue, right? So you can project. In Rhodesia, the whites finally realized what was ahead and have made a brave stand to protect themselves and civilization. It is interesting to note, however, that the entire leadership of the USA is backing the forces of savagery and murder against our own white brothers and sisters in Rhodesia and South Africa. The people of the United States still cannot see that the black hell going on is not sporadic, not spontaneous, not the result of frustration, but the highly organized and planned invasion of our country by the enemy, who has already landed by the millions and is attacking. Imagine what he would say about today when they're left the borders open to millions of invading third worlders, along with the blacks already here. If they got off of ships and ran up a beach and did what they were doing to our cities, it would be stopped immediately. Ha ha. Nah, it wasn't. It is happening and has not been stopped. In fact, we just needed 50 more years of being drenched in leftist propaganda, anti-white propaganda, to make people feel that it's impossible to resist. But since our chart forgers and liars with their, quote, love and brotherhood baloney keep most of America believing there is no plan behind it, we tolerate a yearly escalation of the attack upon us by millions of blacks and communists, including most of our own leaders. Correct, it advances by degrees. But here I would find a fault. He's got to trace all that back to Christianity, and he doesn't. He's still trapped in the... There's much heavier emphasis on the political stuff. That's when you're talking about communists instead of the racial stuff, which should be talking about the Jews who created communism and Christianity as a fellow ism in order to destroy white nations. You destroy white nations, okay, you can do that by murdering white people, but you can do it more subtly, more slowly and more surely. Well, not more surely, but more easily for yourself by spreading ideas that destroy white people. One of those ideas is the idea that race doesn't matter, that we are all created by the same God, that we all have individual worth. And once you do that, once you create and spread the idea that every hominem member of the rodeo race, it can stand on its back legs for 8 seconds as a human created by God, and that is the most fundamental and the most important equality of all. The practical result of accepting that belief is it becomes almost infinitely harder to maintain any kind of social, legal, cultural barricade against leveling in every mundane way. Every earthly way, every physical way, every national way. Why would you want to put up any kind of legal, social, or other barrier between yourself and another of God's creations? This is the poisonous doctrine Jews spread for whites called Christianity. And Rockwell will never, ever go into this because he's still coming from kind of that conservative Christian background that has been and needed to be awakened to the reality of Jews and race. But he's still mostly thinking of this and framing a political way. To repeat myself, he's talking about communists rather than Jews. The communists are political ism. Jews are a race. A race is using the blacks to attack whites. Blacks are a tool. Browns are a tool that Jews use to attack the white race they are trying to destroy. Communism is one of the ideologies they use to destroy whites, along with Christianity and conservatism and liberalism. White nationalism is illegal or called hate, because white nationalism is the idea that can save whites by getting them to value themselves and see themselves as distinct, a bespoke race created by nature for whatever reason to fill a particular circumstantial niche. And yet when you look at it, it has valuable and things that you want to preserve and save and extend and grow. So white nationalism is the opposite of these other isms created by Jews. White nationalism is created by whites who value themselves. And it begins with an understanding of what we are, where there's an unbridgeable gap between the Christian conception of what men are, let alone white men, and the white nationalist conception of what men are, whether white, black, or other. We are interested in physical reality. They are interested in an ideology. And as I say, that ideology comes from Jews, the Jew Saul, most notably. So, he's saying that the few whites who realized early enough to defend themselves are still being attacked by our own white leaders in the USA. Now says, one of the purposes of this book, White Power, is to alert our people to this deadly threat. And one of the best ways to do that is to listen, all caps, to the enemy. He's not hiding what he plans. He boasts about it. I have printed only a tiny fraction of the available documents that you can get. Just to show what I mean, Here, and I'm working off a PDF online, so there may be, well be pics in the actual physical book. Here's the back page of one of these crusaders put out by Robert Williams, the guy behind the broadcast above. You can get one for yourself by writing to the person and address shown on the back of this vile communist plan for the murder and rape of America. Some misprints. Professors in Japan who are interested in the affairs and the problem of the Negro people. It is not only an academic research group, but it moves against any racial discrimination and participation in democratization movements in Japan. They send delegates to the Afro-Asian People Solidarity Congresses and cooperate with the Japanese Committee Anti-Racial Discrimination in South Africa, the Kobe City University Society. Aside from these activities, publishes a quarterly bulletin which brings up-to-date information to the Japanese people on the liberation struggle of Afro-Americans and includes literary works by Negroes and historical informative articles in the Japanese language. Tune in to Radio Free Dixie, 690 on the dial, long wave, best reception, transistor, car, and home radios without thy aerial, Friday, 10 to 11 p.m. Sunday, and Tuesday, 11 to 12 midnight, EST. Crusader Appeal. Help build the Crusader. We need volunteer distributors throughout the world. We especially need people in the black ghettos to pass our message along. Help by distributing the Crusader in your church, school, club, place of employment, or unemployment line. Financial contributions needed. Also jazz records for Radio Free Dixie. Send for your bundle today to The Crusader, Mrs. Ann Olson, 21 Ellis Gardens, Toronto 3, Ontario, Canada. Published in Cuba as a private publication. The Crusader. This filth is distributed in North America by a woman in Canada named Ann Olson, as the photostat shows. That's how we got what you've already seen. Here's a letter we received from this wretched woman showing how relatively easy it is to get this material. Now that you've seen some samples from this crusader and seen the letter from Mrs. Olson of 21 Ellis Gardens, let me supply another piece of the puzzle, a truly frightening piece, says Rockwell. Remember that through all these documents, the communist race agitators call for attacking the white man's sources of electricity first, so that they can spread their terror in the blackout. That is the recurrent theme in the crusader. Again and again, the American Mau Mau leader emphasizes that the first step in seizing America by terrorism is to smash the power plants and create mass blackouts. Mrs. Ann Olson of 21 Ellis Gardens funnels this material to Negroes all over North America. Why do I repeat that name and address twice? Because there is something startling about somebody else who lives at 21 Ellis Gardens. Mr. Olson, Mrs. Olson's husband, went to visit Castro's Cuba in the summer of 1965. 3 months later, on November 9th, 1965, the Sir Adam Beck No. 2 hydroelectric plant near Toronto, Ontario, experienced a monstrous power failure, which spread utter darkness throughout the night from New York City to Canada, one quarter of the USA plus Canada. The Sir Adam Beck No. 2 hydroelectric plant near Toronto, Ontario. Mr. Olson works as the technician at the Sir Adam Beck No. 2 hydroelectric plant. See Christian Crusade Bulletin, March 1966, page 5, probably one of the Southern White publications. There used to be a lot of. Is this not at least suspicious? Sus, as the kids say nowadays. Yet the officers of the National Energy Board of Canada, the officials of the Hydroelectric Power Commission of Ontario, and the U.S. Power Commission, who investigated the power failure, never once mentioned this curious fact. but engaged in a lot of double talk about miscalculations. Mistake rather than sabotage. Other power failures since then. Texas, New Mexico, and Mexico later in 1965. Cincinnati and Kentucky in May 1967. Pennsylvania, New Jersey, New York, and Delaware in June 1967. Miscalculations? Blacking out 30 million people for 12 or more hours? Would it not be at least prudent to check on Mr. Olson to see if he did what all he and his wife recommend? All caps. So you've got these evil white people who may not even be Jews. I don't know. Jews don't use Olson as a cover name, but it makes sense that they would. Are spreading, disseminating black anti-white communist propaganda. And when suspicious events happen, they're not even really being investigated. Gee. And see, these patterns go on a lot longer than you think. If you notice something, it's been going on a lot longer than you realized. Never kid yourself. Meanwhile, there is unfortunately a good deal of truth in what Williams and these black terrorists are preaching. That while Americans have grown strong in weapons and machinery, we have grown soft and dependent on that machinery and weaponry. I remember well that in World War II, we won partly because of enormous superiority in firepower and materiel. We sat on the Japs and Germans, much as a fat man could sit on a tough but tiny fighter, even if the fat man couldn't fight a lick. Not that Americans can't fight, it's just that we have ever more and more machines and firepower to do it for us, and we get more and more dependent on that easy, mechanized ways every day. We are losing the fighting ferocity of our forefathers, which whipped the Indians and everybody else in sight. We are becoming a nation of button pushers. Quote, if ever the TV and radio goes off, the electricity is shut off, the telephone is gone, the water disappears, and there is nobody to tell them what to do, most white Americans will panic, boasts this black communist terrorist, Robert Williams. And Williams is right. They'll sit around in the dark waiting for the radio to come back on and tell them what to do, he continues. And he's right again, unless we change things. Page 198. Now add the fact that the Negroes in Los Angeles, Detroit, Chicago, Cleveland, and many other cities have already proved that they can conquer the entire police departments of these huge cities. Only the National Guard, with heavy weapons and tanks, has been able to restore order. In Detroit, even the National Guard are not enough, and the Army had to be called. The police by themselves are helpless. And every day they apply more and more handcuffs, review boards, etc., to make the police still more helpless, and they work to get guns away from white people. But that's not the real danger, nor the final aim of the black revolutionists. As shown by the Crusader photostats, they're after the armed forces. Day after day, week after week, year after year, the blacks pour into our Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marine Corps and National Guard. All recent presidents and political leaders have gone way overboard, ensuring that Negroes get favored in promotions over white men. Not just equal, but favored. He's in this mid-late 60s. So this has been going on for the better part of 100 years, where whites have been screwed in the military. President Kennedy even set up a Jew, Abe Fortas, to make the Gesell Report, G-E-S-E-L-L, a special study to find ways to make more and more and more Negroes officers and non-coms by setting up political commissars in almost every unit, usually black, to report any senior official not pushing Negroes up or promoting them. It's going on now as you read these lines. Commissar, again, that's a directly Soviet Union, the idea of a political officer assigned to a unit to ensure that everybody there is promoting the official Jew ideology, which is always anti-white, while making the upper ranks blacker and blacker and blacker for political reasons rather than honest merit. Remember,
the fear principle that Hitler had. Like, you demonstrate your competence in a micro unit, which are given pretty wide latitude in how they achieve. Tell someone what to do, not how to do it. And if you demonstrate your superiority, that would be evident and you would be promoted. The leadership principle, essentially. Those who take initiative and demonstrate ability receive the promotion. That's why you have the constantly rising competence. But anyway, so Kennedy stepped forward to us to make a report, you know, study this and how can we get more blacks promoted, et cetera, et cetera. All the stuff we have now going on, not only in the Army, but in corporate America today. As a result, the services are filling up faster and faster with Negroes, and especially with black bosses, black corporals, black sergeants, black lieutenants, all the way up to black generals. Today, all services except the Navy are between 1/4 and 1/8 Negro, with an even higher percentage of Negro non-coms, non-commissioned officers. See the Gazelle report. Ask yourself what happens in every neighborhood when the Negroes move in. Don't the whites move out? Even the Jews are recognizing that U.S. cities of the North are now more segregated than the South as a result of the flight of the whites to the suburbs, as the blacks have gotten more and more numerous in the cities. When blacks move in, whites move out. I don't know when the term white flight was coined. I'm going to look that up and find out at a later point. And that's precisely what is happening in our armed forces, exactly as planned. Except for draftees who have no choice, and again, they're getting into the middle of Vietnam. The armed forces are filling up with Negroes, and Negroes are getting the commands. Any effort to stop the upward rush of Negroes by honest white officers is blasted as bigotry, and the white officer who tries to insist on merit, even by blacks, is himself discriminated against. I know. I was in not too long ago. The blacks reenlist, whites get out. The process is one which goes faster and faster and feeds on itself. If you've ever seen a neighborhood go black, you know what I mean. First one Negro, then few, then quite a few, then suddenly the whole neighborhood is black. That's the way it's happening in the Army, Air Force, Marines, and to a lesser extent, to the Navy. We think we are protected behind a barrier of rockets, nuclear weapons, and other technological machinery, which are undoubtedly the most powerful the world has ever seen. Not true today. But if that machinery and weaponry falls under the control of the enemy, it is not only useless to us, it is sure death. At this very moment, the sellout politicians and demagogues are turning these mighty technical weapons over to more and more Africans. And the blacks, in turn, are falling more and more under the control of the Mau Mau revolutionists. Aside from the danger we face from our own armed forces in black hands, there is the personal danger you face on a man-to-man basis from the organization of the new generation of black guerrilla fighters in the big cities of the North. In Chicago, there is an enormous criminal gang of black teenagers called the Mighty Blackstone Rangers, numbering in the thousands. There used to be a smaller gang called the Disciples, but they have recently merged with the Rangers to make the largest black killer gang in the United States. They are so highly organized, they have command centers, use walkie-talkies, and negotiate peace treaties, quote-unquote, with the chief of police of Chicago on television. They are the terror of Chicago. Today, most of them are still teenagers. They are the result of 20 years of your paying gigantic welfare taxes to breed literally millions of these black animals without roots, without homes, without morals, without any respect for anything, let alone authority. The average white American has forgotten his heritage of violence. I know I had until I launched the American Nazi Party. As a kid in school, of course, you have a few fist fights. Maybe, like me, you were also in a couple of wars. But even in wars, hand-to-hand combat, violence to the death is rare. Not one in a thousand experiences it. But violence to the death was the day-to-day life of the human race for millennia. And day-to-day violence to the death is still the way of life of most big city Negroes. They go at one another with knives, razors, guns, axes, gouging hands, and even teeth.
They are used to it and don't get particularly shook up when suddenly overwhelmed by an explosion of this kind of deadly violence, any more than a dog is shook up over a dogfight. Most importantly, these millions of young, tough blacks have learned the art of violence to the death. They know what to do. Do you? What would you do if attacked right now by a gang of hoods with clubs, knives, guns, and bombs? These highly organized blacks are familiar with violence and know how to use it and defend from it. Millions of them even enjoy it. It doesn't panic them. But most white men have become spiritually soft in terms of being ready, from moment to moment, to fight to the death, personally. When these millions of black teenagers now learning personal violence and terrorism in the streets of our big cities are in their 20s, and heavily armed, as many of them already are, they will be ready for a revolution of personal violence which will stun the average white man and leave him helpless. I know these black kids. They're so used to violence and horror, they laugh in its presence. They fear no policeman, no gun, and no knife, nothing. They have little to lose, and their status in their own black gang is based on their utter disdain for danger and violence. Caged up with these black wild animals in jails, as I often am, is a terrifying education. We are putting tens of thousands of these black killers into uniform and handing them the deadliest weapons in the history of the world. Just what do you think will happen when they decide to turn those weapons on you, as we have shown is planned? Already Negroes are rebelling at killing colored people, the enemy, Viet Cong, and their more rad leaders such as Stokely Carmichael, and now King, Martin Luther King, are telling them to commit sedition, not fight. And our cowardly government is letting them get away with this sedition. How long do you think this can go on without an uprising in the armed forces? Also as planned and documented. And just how do you think the armed forces could put down such a black uprising from within when every man of the white troops has been taught that to oppose Negroes is hate, when many of the officers are black, when the fighters among our white race have been prematurely retired like the immortal Chesty Puller of the Marine Corps and a thousand others, when the whites are completely disorganized while the blacks have instant and almost perfect communications, when every black leader is paraded on TV and the international press so all the blacks can know and be ready to obey, while there are no real white leaders, because anybody who dares to call himself a white leader is blacked out of the press or so disgraced as a bigot and hater that he cannot be effective within his own people. During the first hours of such a black uprising in our armed forces, in fact, many of the whites would help the enemy, and also as planned and documented in the Crusader. Our people have become so damnably brainwashed and beaten down by the Jewish doses of brotherhood and love propaganda, not to mention naked communist propaganda for the blacks, that our population and armed forces swarm with nigger lovers, white men who really believe it is their duty, for one reason or another, to prefer these blacks to their own people. If properly set, by being told the black uprising was for the purpose of getting a more liberal brotherhood government job, lots of these damn fool white men would join the side of their deadly enemies long enough to give victory to these savages and their Jew communist leaders. Precisely this has happened in every country where the Reds have seized power and the stupid collaborators have then been liquidated by the Reds and blacks as the fools and dangerous turncoats they are, the useless idiots sector, the leftists, the non-Jew leftists. I am well aware that, as I dictate this, it all seems too wild and impossible to be worthy of belief or even investigation. I myself would not have believed it were I you, or had I not investigated and found the same thing happening time after time all over the planet, with the victims always flabbergasted and unable to believe that it could have been true. The title of this chapter is Nightmare. That title refers not only to what is ahead for all of us if we let it happen, but to the indescribable agony of those who know. If you are one of the few people who have been warning America of her deadly peril, only to find that nobody will listen, then you know the nightmare whereof I speak. The nearest thing to it is when I was a kid and went to one of those horror movies where the hairy hand keeps reaching out to seize the unsuspecting heroine from behind. You want to scream at her, "Watch out, behind!" only you can't. America today is that unsuspecting, carefree heroine, happily engaged in everything trivial, while the black, hairy paw with the hammer and sickle on it creeps closer and closer and closer. God grant that we may be able to shout to her to wake up in time. This time, it's no movie. That hairy, ape-like black claw has already closed around the throats of dozens of unsuspecting nations before us. For 50 years, it has been happening to one victim after another. And what have we been doing about it? That's the end of the chapter 11 called Nightmare by George Lincoln Rockwell, discussing how if we're soft and weak, blacks pick up on it and they're armed and trained by Jews and given bogus doctrines, isms, whether it's black nationalism or race-free universalism of communism or Christianity, and how these are all used to trick whites into being raped, murdered, and having everything that they ever created stolen from us. That's a terrible future. You can see exactly what he meant from 50, 60 years later. It's gotten worse and worse by degree. Well, thanks for being with me today. I've been Alex Slender reading to you of George Lincoln Rockwell's late 60s book, White Power, specifically Chapter 11, Nightmare, and everything that we do as part of the Learning College can be found at vnnforum.com. Thanks for listening, and I'll be back with you again real soon.